Thank you very much to Derek Goffert and everyone at Bristol for the honor of the invitation to be here. And I must say it's an honor, also daunting, to speak in front of this learned audience about the subject today. What I want to explore is the link between language, identity, and national identity in the works of Shishkov, Rostopchin, and Sergei Glinka. We're looking at the years 1803 to 1817. 1803 because that's when Shishkov published his first major philological work linking identity with language. And 1817, because that is the time when Glinka finished his Russian history, which, to my knowledge, is the first Russian history that begins more or less at the beginning, but ends with the expulsion of the French and defeat of Napoleon. So, a couple of preliminary observations. Shishkov and Rostopchin are high officials who, in the period just before 1812, were out of favor. But, of course, in 1812, they played important roles. Shishkov as state secretary to Alexander and Rostopchin in Moscow. Glinka was a writer. He was a publicist, responsible with Biketa for the journal Russian Courier. And as far as I know, he was not particularly well connected with the political elites, except through his publicistic activity. So these are people that have a different perspective on officialdom and politics. So that's the first observation. The second observation is, although these people are gallophobic in their perspectives, they knew French very well. One of the first publications of Shishkov was a dictionary in three languages. He was also a translator. He translated Rome's book on the construction of naval vessels into Russian. Rostopchin wrote both in French and in Russian. In fact, a short memoir that he wrote toward the end of his life is written first in French and then translated into Russian. And then he wrote a self-justification, The Truth About the Fire in Moscow of 1812, wrote it in French, and then that was translated into Russian. And as for Glinka, he was educated at the Imperial Kadetsky Corpus, but the curriculum there was predominantly French, and he writes about the kinds of things that he read as a student there, mostly French literature. So those are beginning observations. As to context, there are several contexts that we have to bear in mind. One is the publication by Lomonosov of an essay on the uses of church language for Russian writing. This was particularly important to Shishkov, and he refers to it directly in his 1803 Rumination on the Russian Language. Second context is what we've been talking about here, directly and indirectly, which is the debate between about 1750 and 1780 on the place of Russian language and culture in Russia. And of course, that debate takes place in journals like Novikov's journal, but it also takes place in the theater. And for the purposes of our people, Shishkov paid a great deal of attention to Sumarokas and the French writings, his play Titeni Sud. And I think Rostopchin was influenced by Brigadier of von Wiese. At least I see some parallelisms between his writing and von Wiese. A third context, which to my mind hasn't been sufficiently mentioned here, is the pan-European debate about language that originates with Hamann and Herder. And basically, Hamann argued that language comes from the interaction of God and human beings. Language is also, therefore, reflective of human experience in history, according to this view. And language is constitutive of thought and therefore of identity, of a person's identity. It's kind of an idealist interpretation of language. Herder's views on language are similar, except he says language doesn't necessarily come from God. It's the product of human experience. But in the other two respects, he shares Hamann's views. Herder also developed in his book, Ideas Toward a Philosophy of Human History, he developed the idea that there is one human nature. He called it humanitate. It's there everywhere. And this is very much an Enlightenment point of view. But since the beginning of time, humans have lived separately in individual communities and spoken separate languages. And he points out that there is grave difficulty in translating one language from another. Languages are not equivalent. Translation is an intellectually perilous exercise. Now, he thinks that in principle it's possible to do good translations, but he thinks there are very few of these, and they're hard to achieve. It seems to me that in Herder's work, there is a tension between the universal or general humanistic side of his thinking and the particularistic nationalist side of his thinking. And it was easy for some Europeans who were interested in promoting nationalism to take that particularistic part and promote it. And I think that Fichte, Johann Gottfried Fichte, in his addresses to the German nation, delivered in 1807-1808, takes the particularistic side of Herder and uses it in his defense of the superiority of German language over French language and so on. And the last context we're already reminded of by Brian's paper, which is that in this period we are either at danger of war between French and Russia or actually in conflict. So those are the contexts. Shishkov's work, it seems to me, is relatively well known, but let me just remind you of some central points. Like Lomonosov, he points to the importance of church language, first as a vehicle of vivid expression. He thinks that the concision and power of church language gives to Russian writers a power of expression that is unparalleled and is superior to the possibilities that are afforded to the French. Zhishkov also points to the difficulty of translation, even though he's a translator himself. In fact, he almost suggests the incommensurability of languages. He says that if you take a word, it has a denotation, that is a type meaning, but also many connotative meanings. And you translate from one language to another, you might be able to capture the connotation or the denotation, but not the many connotations of a word in the original language. And because of this perilousness, difficulty that is inherent in the process of translation, he felt that many translations from French to Russian resulted in intellectual confusion on the part of Russians, and in fact the impoverishment of Russian literature rather than its advancement. And the final point that Zhishkov makes is that it is important for Russian writers to access the power of the ancient Slavonic language if they are going to write effective secular prose. So in other words, you have to know the spiritual roots of the language in order to write for a secular audience. And this is the reason why it is important for Russians to attend to their own tradition and love it, rather than to spend so much time paying attention to the French. He doesn't go so far as to say one shouldn't study another language or to argue for hermetically closing Russia against outside influences. But his point is you have to love your own language, know its history. Only then can you have a culture that will grow. From 1810 to 1812, he develops the political, I would say, or patriotic side, the implications that were latent in this earlier piece of 1803. So he says flatly, for example, that a cosmopolitan is a person without country, but also standing effectively outside of humanity. Cosmopolitan doesn't know his own parents, so to speak. Therefore, he is not Homo sapiens. He's something that is subhuman and therefore dangerous to the species of humanity. And there's an interesting play, if you read the introduction of Karamzin's History of Russia, where he's thinking about cosmopolitanism and nationalism. Between Zhishkov's sentiments and Karamzin's. All right. Rostopchin, I think, is not a philologist. He's not particularly interested in cultural matters, except to the degree that they are politically important. I would go so far as to say that he is a realpolitiker, whose views of Russian culture and language were instrumental. So up to 1804, for example, he doesn't particularly fear the French. He fears the British. He's not really disturbed by the notion that disturbed Zhishkov, that there might be corruption in Russian culture that can't be overcome. It's only when Russia begins to fight against the French and he begins to fear for national survival that he starts to emphasize the dangers of Gallicisms and French culture in Russia. He does this through a series of fictions, short essays. One of them is The Thoughts Aloud on the Red Staircase, which he wrote in 1807. There are others. And then there's a play written in 1807, 1808, called News or a Slain Survivor, which is about the news of the Battle of Eylau, as that's received in the Russian countryside. Essentially, it seems to me, Rostopchin repeats all of the standard epithets about the dangers of French culture. Russians who love the French have forgotten who they are. Russians who love the French because of this cultural amnesia, plunged into moral corruption. They are politically confused. And of course, he makes the point, since Russia is then at war with the French, that loving the French is loving the people who have cut off heads like cabbages and invaded their neighbors. So this love by the Russians of the French is moderate, dangerous, and must be expunged if possible. Now to Glinka. Glinka's younger than both Zhishkov and Rostopchin. He grew up, as I said, educated in a French curriculum and French-speaking milieu, and with a French, pro-French orientation. In fact, he tells us in his memoirs that his great hero, that of other people in his school, was Napoleon. And he looked on Napoleon as a modern Julius Caesar. For him, that was a good thing. And he actually wanted to serve under Napoleon's colors. That is to say, he wanted this until 1805, when he realized that the French army might sometime soon invade Russia. And especially 1806, when he joined the militia, and he identified himself passionately with the peasantry. Now, Glinka says that circa 1806, 1807, he plunged into a completely different world. And this is the world of old Russian chronicles. In other words, he turns from this Francophone world in which he was originally educated and self-educates himself in the reading of Russian chronicles, many of them, of course, at this stage published by Novikov at the end of the 18th century. And this is the preparation for the writing of the history of Russia with which he is engaged. I want to say something about social orientation. Both Zhishkov and Rostopchin were defenders of serfdom, but Glinka was not. Glinka believed that the Russian community was one, that there was an artificial barrier between people, a barrier of class, and he wanted to see that artificial barrier struck down. He wanted to see serfdom eliminated. So there's a big difference in his social view. His multi-volume, 12-volume history of Russia is built, I think, on a tension. The tension, on the one hand, between God, who ordained history, and on the other hand, between people who are faithful to God and constitute the true human actors that make history possible. In between God and the people is the state. And for Glinka, the state is epiphenomenal. It is not important. Many times, state actors such as Napoleon, and he gives this example over and over in the last volumes of his book, these people are blinded, they are arrogant, they don't understand the march of history as ordained by God, and they're not connected with the people from below. So, for him, one is a proper historical actor to the degree that one is loyal to God's vision, to the providential design of history, and loyal to the people's place in that vision. So, to conclude about the significance of this talk and these people, all of these people make a connection between language, culture, and politics. All of them are to one degree or another conservative. But there are differences in their conservatism. The first two, Glinka accepted here, so Shishkov and Rostopchin, are statists. They think the state plays an important and a positive role in history. And obviously, Glinka is not a statist. Both of the first two speak from the point of view of the educated public, but Glinka self-identifies with the people as the human motor force of history responding to God. These are very important nuances, although the linguistic nationalism that we are witnessing here in Staten Nashendi is the important big phenomenon. One other point here. Collectively, these people set the stage for the development of Russian nationalism in the 19th century. But Glinka, it seems to me, gives us something more. He gives us a first draft of the national myth that Lev Tolstoy, developed with genius in War and Peace. Because you have here the epiphenomenal state, you have here the deluded Napoleon, you have here the idea that the war is a national war as well as a patriotic war, and that the outcome somehow had to do with divine or providential or ordination. So that's the shape of my talk, and I'd be glad to entertain any questions.